Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Black History Month started as Negro History Week in 1926. The idea was to highlight African American achievements throughout American history, but the transport of enslaved Africans to the American shores started 400 years ago, and most agree a month just isn't enough. The Southern Poverty Law Center found that more than half of American teachers believe current history textbooks are both outdated and incomplete because most lessons end with the abolition of slavery and pick up again 100 years later with the Civil Rights Movement. We're talking about that 100-year gap today, why it matters. Ohio State Associate Professor Hassan Kwame Jeffries participated in the Southern Poverty Law Center study. He hosts the Teaching Hard History podcast, and he teaches African-American history at Ohio State. He joins us. Welcome back.
Thank you very much. Great to be here.
Professor Marilyn K. Howard teaches American history and African American history at Columbus State Community College. She joins us as well. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Professor Howard, how would you assess the general knowledge of African American history among your students?
They don't know very much. I mean, they know some of the larger events, like everybody knows I Have a Dream, or the Montgomery bus boycott, but they're fuzzy on the details. They often get things confused. Context, I think the hardest thing for me to teach is context. For some reason, students have a tremendous trouble with that. But they don't know very much.
You mean, for instance, during the Montgomery bus boycott, the circumstances of African-Americans in Montgomery, Alabama at the time of the boycott?
Context, the stuff doesn't just spring up like Topsy. I mean, it has a whole background and everything. And then, so that's difficult. They don't have that.
First, I mean, in order to teach the impact of the boycott, first you have to teach the fact that public transportation was so important to African-Americans, blah, blah, blah.
Yes.
The whole thing.
Yes.
Gotcha. Yeah.
So that's a really big concept for them, and then I struggle to get that across.
Do you ever see the lights go on upstairs?
Sometimes. When we talk about the Black Panthers, for one thing, most people are taught that they're this evil paramilitary group that went around slitting the throats of white people or something. And then when they free breakfast, free lunch, health clinic, freedom schools, that kind of thing. Oh, so yes. Yes, and that's what we all teach for it. It's very gratifying. Doesn't happen often, but when it happens, you take it.
You know, a recent Columbus Dispatch editorial said that if there hadn't been centuries of deliberate suppression of African-American history, there would not be the resulting ignorance that leave many Americans not seeing a problem, particularly many white Americans, mm-hmm. of course. And I'm wondering, Hassan Kwame Jeffries, what do we know about how that deliberate suppression worked?
Oh, we know a lot about it. I mean, it wasn't sort of a secret about the ways in which the experience of African Americans has been misconstrued, literally dating back from, you know, the earliest textbooks to the earliest schools. I mean, the ways in which African people were depicted and discussed as subjects of history, moving from sort of slavery into emancipation, the emancipation era, the ways in which enslaved people were depicted, the ways in which the Confederacy and the lost mythology of the lost cause comes into being. So we know that from the very beginning, the formal instruction on the African-American experience has been rife with misconceptions and misunderstandings and misstatements that have been purposeful. And that's the other key, right?
Right.
These aren't just sort of accidents. Oh, I didn't realize. I didn't understand.
We didn't know that any better back then.
No, no. I mean, when they're writing about, you know, the Dunning School is writing about fabrications about Reconstruction, these are purposeful fabrications that serve a particular political purpose.
Is any of that being still taught in the United States?
You have, I think, within our educational system, both problems of commission and omission. You still have a not just sort of a whitewashing, but a sanitizing of American history. American. I mean, we're talking about sort of this Disney version of the American experience.
Imported farm workers.
Exactly. Yeah. As opposed to, you know, people who were being purchased as enslaved folk. Right.
Right.
So the sanitizing is problematic. But then it's also sort of a leaving out right? Which is so you can mention slavery, but you only talk about it in economic terms, and then you'll jump from sort of Reconstruction or emancipation all the way to the Civil Rights era, with sort of a century of history in between that's just completely overlooked. That is just as problematic as looking at it from the wrong perspective, or mistakenly looking at it, because it doesn't explain anything. You completely lose the explanatory force of the historical experience.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about African-American history as American history, as a constant throughout the teaching of American history. It runs a thread, a very strong thread, prominent thread. America wouldn't be the same as it is today without African-American history in it. We want to hear from our listeners. What do you think? What did you learn? How would you like to learn differently, or how would you like your children to be taught when it comes to these issues? Do you think it should be a full-time, year-round thing, or is it should be relegated to a month as it is now? 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. African American contributions and achievements are visible throughout history, but how do you know? I mean, is there a template, Professor Howard, for how you weave that in? How do you even begin the process of weaving it in?
Well, I don't teach American history very much anymore. But when I did teach it, I always, tried to, in every chunk of the chapter, I tried to sort of weave that in. How has this impacted black people? And how have black people impacted America? And the other thing is, I'm a social historian, so I'm interested in the history of the masses. So I don't do a lot of talking about great people.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
I'm interested in how everyday people, those of us in this room, are reacting to what's going on.
Huh. And Hassan, well, how does it change? I mean, when you're talking about a kindergartner or a first grader learning about the Civil War, I don't even know what they teach first graders anymore. But I grew up in the generation where they started to say it was a war of economics.
Right.
And
right.
They used these euphemisms, and they really did downplay slavery.
Right. No, part of what has to be done is not just incorporating and weaving the African-American experience into the American experience writ large. Black folk are here from day one,
right?
And we're still here, and don't look like we're going anywhere anytime soon. I mean, so it has to be woven in, right, throughout the curriculum. If you're looking at sort of a year-long mm-hmm. curriculum, where Black History Month or February becomes a moment to shine a special light, but that special light doesn't really glow unless you've been weaving it in, incorporating it mm-hmm. throughout. So one, it has to be incorporated throughout. And then two, we have to think about it in terms of scaffolding. We don't wait to teach physics or science until the 10th grade or 11th grade. We're teaching physics in preschool, right, when you're talking about objects and movements and force mm-hmm. and the like. And we have to do the same thing with history at large, but then certainly with African-American history. Because if we just wait to introduce, if not slavery or the institution of slavery or the African-American experience or the civil rights movement in third grade or fourth grade and drop in like, hey, this is Martin Luther King, this is Rosa Parks, there's no context for it,
mm-hmm.
right? We have to build up. So what was going on? Always age appropriate, but certainly we can do that because kids have a great sense of right and wrong.
American education, for some reason, has a hard time teaching history, and Americans have had – that's been a shortfall for a long time. And I'm wondering sometimes if it wasn't part of – this whole issue of avoiding so much of the history.
Well, I always
it never
tell my
comes
students
through clearly.
That the winners get to write history.
Right.
So the first person there after whatever has happened gets to write that, gets to frame that. And so that's why we have what we have here, because it's the winners who are writing history. And before history was like a profession and a professional kind of thing, in lots of places, if you're talking about 15th, 16th, 17th century, the only people who were educated were clerics or lawyers. And they wrote history, in their spare time. So that certainly has something to do with it. Yes.
Yeah.
Now, I would add, I have an artist friend, Reggie Gibson, out of Massachusetts, and who made a wonderful observation. He said Americans actually hate history. What they love is nostalgia.
Yes.
And that's something completely different.
That's a really interesting
Gone with the wind kind of thing.
Absolutely. Stuff that makes you feel good about the past. And that's not the American experience, right? You got to take the joy as well as the pain.
Right.
Well, apparently Gone with the Wind isn't as popular as it was when I was growing up because none of my students have ever seen it.
that was the kind of thing where
shut the whole house down.
Yeah. I mean, when I was growing up, there wasn't anything but Gone with the Wind. So that was your sole, cinematic experience with slavery for the most part.
Well, and to go back to what you said about nostalgia, I had stumbled across a little trailer that Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer, who produced Gone with the Wind, would show at theaters in the North because Northerners didn't know anything about slavery, and they had to get why Southern slave owners did what they did. This is about a 10-minute trailer.
Wow.
I've never been able to find it again. I think the copyright, somebody noticed it or something because it's gone. But they had to explain to people north of the Mason-Dixon line about slavery because they would know it. And then they would understand why black people have to be treated this way.
Psychologically, I wonder if there were people who willfully suppressed because of the psychological impact mm-hmm. of the truth on the majority.
Well, I mean, the problem with American history, and I say that purposely, the problem with American history is that if we look at it sort of truthfully and honestly, it doesn't make you really feel good.
No, right.
Like,
yeah.
It's not a feel-good history.
Right.
But there are other things in our lives. I mean, it's violent, right? It's about oppression. I mean, there's some good things. It's not always perpetual progress. But we look at that and we say, "Oh, that's too much. Our kids can't deal with it." I think about those who are embrace Christianity, right? And in God we trust. Have you read the Old Testament lately? I mean, you talk about
violence
and slavery and all this other stuff, right? So I mean, it's that raises the question: why do we teach the history that we teach the way we teach it? What are we afraid of? Right. And what are the real political implications for teaching an honest and truthful story of the American past for the present? I think if we get to that point, then we can say, OK, let's make sense of what's been going on.
And you posit that Americans can take the truth.
They can take the truth. It's upsetting. Yes, I do it with my students all the time. Right. But when we get them, because they haven't really been exposed to these various elements. There's so many elements of the African-American experience, from Jim Crow to lynching, that they have no idea about, presidents owning enslaved folk, right? That when we get them and we then share with them, like, hey, this is what went down, right? I mean, they're upset, but they're not upset with us for sharing. They're upset with those along the way who never shared this history. So they absolutely are ready for the truth and can handle the truth.
You know, sometimes when I get those what I call teachable moments, I don't do extra credit as a general rule, but I'll say, well, let's talk about which presidents own slaves, for instance. If you take one from Washington to Lincoln, 60-some percent of them owned slaves. Washington was one of the second largest slaveholder in Virginia.
Right.
So I say to him, go out and look up, of these 16 presidents, who owned slaves, who didn't. See how many they had and see if they took them to the White House with them. And they are always astounded. But, how can they own slaves and still be president? Or how can they,
how could they write the Constitution?
Yes.
How could they sign the Declaration
exactly.
of Independence? Yeah.
And so I think you're right. I think we have to grasp every teachable moment we can. Sometimes more comes through that than through an actual lecture.
We're talking about how to teach African American history, when to teach it, and the typical way to do it is to wait for 1 week or 1 month a year. That's starting to change. My guests, Marilyn Howard, she teaches American history and African-American history at Columbus State Community College. And also Hassan Kwame Jeffries, he's an associate professor at Ohio State. He participated in the Southern Poverty Law Center study that we talked about earlier, and he hosts the Teaching Hard History podcast, and he teaches African-American history as well. So get your calls in. We've got calls waiting. We'll get to those right away. The number is 614-292-8513. You can also email us at allsides@wosu.org. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. We're talking about African-American history today and how it is so entwined to the larger arc of American history that it cannot be separated, and yet it has been. Martin Luther King Jr. and Rosa Parks are perhaps a couple of the most familiar historical figures in African-American history, and they are important, but there were many others, both within the civil rights movement and beyond, both way before and way after, who have been left out of the story. Not just when it comes to reform movements, but their very role in the fabric of American life, from medicine to education, music, literature, the list goes on and on. African-Americans are part of it all, but we reserve just a month a year to consider that. Still with us, African-American historian and associate an Ohio State associate professor, Hassan Kwame Jeffries, and Professor Marilyn Howard. She teaches American history and African-American history at Columbus State Community College. We'd like to hear from you out there. What do you think? How would you do it differently if you could? 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. I want to get right at something that we were talking about off air, and that is the issue of if you teach about African-American history from the beginning, you also have to teach about the other side of that coin, which is white supremacy, which is kind of at the root of the evil of the enslavement of people. And that's rough. I mean, that it's not that, you know, that then therefore then the idea comes, well, it's not that we don't want to learn about African-American history. It's just we don't want to learn about white American history.
No, absolutely. Slavery as well as Jim Crow are economic systems, right? The reason why they are in place and why they last for so long is because people are making money off of the exploitation of African labor and African American labor. But the broader justification for the systems, for those systems, is a deeply rooted belief in white supremacy that isn't limited to one region, that is a colonial-wide phenomenon, that is a nationwide phenomenon. So we ought not be talking about sort of the American experience, not just the African-American experience, but the American experience, without talking about how deeply rooted white supremacy was, not just certainly leading up to the Civil War by Southerners and those who embraced slavery, but then also by white Northerners, mm-hmm. Those outside of the South, who, including abolitionists, who believed in white supremacy. And the reason why, and after slavery, I mean, white supremacy is the principal legacy, and it, I would argue, of
still
slavery.
Embedded in economic decisions like the labor unions keeping blacks out and that kind of a thing.
Absolutely. I mean, so we cannot talk about sort of the American experience, period, without talking about how white supremacy served as a justification for discriminatory actions and discriminatory behaviors and policies that have shaped the American experience from the Constitution to state law and federal law over the last 250 years. We simply ought not do it, and we can't do it. And if we are doing it, then we are, in fact, miseducating our students. And I would just add that the reason why we do it, because that is what we're doing, is because we're afraid of not so much what it says about the past, certainly that, but what it says about us today, right? How we look at the past is really just a reflection of how we want to think of ourselves today. So our hang-ups with white supremacy today, our hang-ups with racial discrimination today, our hang-ups with inequality today keep us from taking a deep dive and an honest look at the American past, including the African-American past.
Well, we've seen in the last few years two important books come out about the premise about this whole thing of white supremacy. One is a book called White Trash, and then the other one is Hillbilly Elegy. And, you know, one of the things I say to my students, if you are white and poor in America, especially if you were poor white and Southern or poor white in Appalachian, the only difference is you are not black. And so these are things people, children get. They get taught. This is cradle to grave. Jim Crow was cradle to grave. You get that in Sunday school. You get that in Girl Scouts. You get that around the kitchen table. You know, a three-year-old kid can boss around a 55-year-old male enslaved person or a 55-year-old black man, you know, post-Reconstruction. And kids, we teach that. And so this whole idea of it's, I know that white people are really, really afraid of hearing the R word, race. Well, you know, the first defense is, I'm not a racist. But that's not true. And we teach that. And so if we use all the institutions of society to teach white supremacy, it's no wonder that we have such a difficult time doing it, because who wants to be thought of as a racist? So we've moved the idea of racism onto, you know, guys in sheets with eyes cut out and flaming sticks of wood or something, as opposed to everyday kinds of things. And that's been very damaging. I think that's what's happening now during this current presidential administration, is that we're seeing the fruits of that, of stepping around that, of always stepping around that conversation. And I think if people had more of a sense, like, you know, we don't go from emancipation to the modern day freedom movement. There's a whole lot of bad stuff in between. And I think if people had a better sense of that, then it might look different.
Joanne in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Joanne.
Hi, Anne. Hi, distinguished guests. I think it's absolutely positively essential that Black history be taught with all its warts in a spotlight, absolutely, so that kids know when they hear the governor of Virginia 2 weeks ago on national TV refer to slaves as indentured servants, they will know that that is a total crock.
It wasn't too many years ago, and I know this has changed, but visiting Mount Vernon in Virginia, and they said, well, there over there is the servants' quarters. I was like, really? Are you actually
Mulberry Row, the servants' quarters?
Yeah, seriously. Joanne, thanks a lot. I mean, all right, so what about it when people like a governor of a state makes references like that?
Let me try to defend him just a little bit.
Okay.
Because he apparently was asking a professor about the first 20 people who came over at Jamestown. And we cannot prove 100% that they were all enslaved. There's some sense that they were maybe unfree indentured servants. Mm-hmm. If you don't know the rest of that, you don't get the nuance of that.
But then, but at the same time, they didn't just show up on the shores of Fort Monroe in Virginia, right? I mean, in other words, they had been kidnapped and sold prior to that point, right?
And the other thing that people miss is that from the time Africans are taken against their will and brought here, there's been a freedom movement. But what do we teach in school? It doesn't start till Brown versus Board of Education, or it doesn't start until Emmett Till or until Truman segregates.
How important is that we learn how it started at the beginning, was the freedom movement was from the very beginning, that people fought against enslavement?
Well, it's critically important, right? Because if we don't talk about resistance, we don't recognize and acknowledge the humanity of the people who are suffering. Resistance is the key way that people connect to people today, connect to people in the past who have been oppressed. When we fail to talk about resistance, then our students and ourselves, we cannot identify with those folks. Like, wow, if they suffered that and quote unquote allowed it to happen, well, then I don't want to have any associates.
I can't relate to
them. I can't connect, right? Yeah. So we have to talk about, otherwise you get these Kanye West moments, right? You have to talk about the resistance, because that is the key way that people connect to the humanity of folk in the past.
And we have to reframe how we define, too, and look at resistance. In our heads in 2019. Resistance is armed resistance, where you get a Uzi or something and mow everybody down. Just getting up in the morning and putting your feet on the floor sometimes is resistance. These people are not going to kill me today. They are not going to steal my joy. They are not going to. That's resistance, too. So we need to enlarge what we think of as resistance today and in 2019.
Let's see. Thomas and Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Thomas.
Hey, and thank you for having this long overdue conversation and taking my call.
You bet.
I'm white, and I learned about Black history way too late at 48 years old when I married a Black woman. I gave a speech for Black History Month saying, why did I have to marry a Black woman to find out, you know, and I literally taught Black history. The response from Black and white in the audience was educational, to say the least. So I wrote Obama and our mayor and the head of the Board of Education, and I said, I see clearly that white children go to school with a phony sense of superiority. We've done everything. They've done nothing. And worse, Black children go to school with a phony sense of inferiority. We haven't done anything. They did it all. So I'm saying that from the start, including our disgusting presidents who had slaves, it shouldn't be Black history. It should be history, identified as by Africans, so we know. But it needs to be integrated completely and from the start. My thanks to all of you.
Thank you, Thomas.
I would add to that what Thomas had said, that we have to also offer a balanced perspective. So the African-American experience isn't all pain. And certainly there's a lot of it.
Yeah, it's right? I've been scorned, kind of thing. Yeah.
If we don't balance the pain mm-hmm. with the joy, right, the pain with the creative culture, the dynamicism, the way in which African-Americans have been able to survive and create and thrive, then you get the dehumanization of folk, right?
Again.
Like nobody wants to be, you know, associated with what did Black folk actually ever do, right? I mean, so it's critically important that we talk about not only the ways in which Black folk have suffered, but the ways in which they have survived despite the suffering, the ways in which they have created this really dynamic culture and contributed, yes, but then also created something so new and fantastic that America
unto
would
itself,
not look the
right.
same.
Yeah, it
unto
wouldn't be itself, the same. And
absolutely.
America wouldn't
and
be the same.
And everybody copies the world over.
Right.
Yes.
I mean, there's a beauty to the African-American experience, right,
mm-hmm. yes.
that has to be uplifted in connection with the ways in which it can be used as a prism to really unearth the truth about the American experience and American past.
Iris in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Iris.
Hi. And roughly I'm a contemporary of yours. I lived in West Michigan roughly the same time you did. I went to college in Michigan same time you did. I did not learn very much about Black history
right.
when I was in grade school and high school.
Yep.
Because of the conversation you had with Dr. Jeffries last year on your program, I wound up going to his lecture over at Bexley. Then I started listening to his podcast. Then I started buying specific books dealing with the issue of race in American society. One of the books is So You Want to Talk About Race by, and I'm going to slaughter her last name, Olumo, and a couple of other ones. I've learned a great deal because of programs like this. I am talking to my grandkids and my nieces and nephews and their kids about the difference in American history from when I learned it in the 60s, 70s, and 80s mm. to today. And I want to thank you and Dr. Jeffries in particular for his excellent program and his podcast.
Thank you, Iris. Thanks for listening. I appreciate it. Take care.
And thank you, Iris. No, that's exactly what we want, right? I mean, that's what we want to do. We want to move. We do the scholarship. We do the work. We get the degrees. We write the books. But then it doesn't really do any good unless we're willing to take it out beyond sort of the gates of the ivory tower, the campus, and into the community. So I look forward to hanging out with Iris some more.
let's see. Fred in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Fred. Hello, Fred. Okay, we'll just hold that. Michelle in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Michelle.
Hi, thank you so much. Listening to your conversation, I have to say, now with two daughters in college, we as a family purposely supplemented their history at home. So we made sure that they not only knew about the history of our family, but the history of African Americans in our country. And I don't know if it's because I went to an HBCU, I was very blessed to meet people like Coretta Scott King when I lived in Atlanta and the Lowrys. And so it was just such a great understanding to not only meet these people, but to literally hear the history from their own lips. So it was very important for us to make sure that our children knew about the history of African Americans, and not just in February. We make it a year-round event. And now one daughter in college is actually going to be minoring in African-American studies, majoring in education. So we hope that we've touched her life to help others to learn more about our history.
Now, you raise an excellent point that I think is worth underscoring, and that is while we have talked about our educational system over the decades really failing us as a nation and students, the African-American community has always supplemented what children have learned in schools through conversations at home, through deep study at home, through study groups in the community, through church education. I mean, that has been this critical aspect. The reason why we have Black History Month in the first place is because of Carter G. Woodson and professional organizations like ASLA. So there's always been this sort of parallel track of learning and education that is informal, just as what she said, parents talking to children, but then also formal through professional organizations like ASALH, as well as historically Black colleges and universities.
I have a bevy of nieces and nephews. I now have great nieces and great nephews, and the oldest of them, it's 15, the youngest are 2, and I've started libraries for them. So the 6-year-old last year for her birthday got a couple of – she's learning to read, so she got a couple of books, one about Ann Lowe, the designer who made Jackie Kennedy's wedding dress, and about a woman who baked pies during the Montgomery bus boycott. So they are getting – I'm starting libraries for them, and they will have that.
I think, as much as I've tried to educate myself over the years, when I saw the movie Hidden Figures, I was – I was truly angry. How in the world could that be suppressed, that incredible story about anybody? Period. It's still shocking to me. And they make the point, I think, pretty clearly in the movie that not only were they African-Americans, they're African-American women. So there's more sublimation that takes place within the community, and it's distressing.
Yeah, and the odd thing about, if we talk about white supremacy and oppression and things like that, we have to look at the fact that so many people then and now are so racist that they would hurt other white people to keep Black people behind. You think about this, Prince Edward County closed their school system for 5 years rather than comply with Brown versus Board of Education. If you were a working class white student or a poor white student, you lost 5 years of school right along with the rest of those Black students.
It's the rich people who could start the private schools that did fine.
Exactly.
Well, all things being equal. Right. We're going to continue our conversation. We're talking about Black history as American history. It's always been segregated in the lesson books. It's starting to change now. Give us a call. Tell us what you think. 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Black History Month traditionally is set aside as a time to focus on African-American history, but that must not be enough. The Southern Poverty Law Center found that only 8% of American students could identify slavery as the central cause of the Civil War. We're talking about African-American history today, how it's taught, and whether it can be taught adequately in just a month out of the year. I think most people agree that it cannot. Still with us, African-American history historian, associate professor at Ohio State, Hassan Kwame Jeffries. Also, Marilyn Howard. She teaches African-American history at Columbus State Community College. And joining us is Keisha Gibbs. She manages the Martin Luther King branch of the Columbus Metropolitan Library. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
We were just talking about how you have a nice brand new building to work with.
Yes, it's beautiful. We do.
Teaching history takes creativity. Getting people into the library takes another level of creativity. How do you get what's your draw? How do you make it work at your branch?
Well, we basically are here as a resource for the community. So we're there for what they need. So we have people coming in for a variety of things, from books to needing to make copies to needing to use the computers. We also have people that are coming in and using it as a community space.
Just to be. Like for meetings and that kind of a
thing. For meetings, we have our students from East High School that come over every day, and it's that third place. They're there with their friends, and they're doing their homework.
Just the library system was a big deal back in the day. There was segregated as well.
God bless public libraries. I tell you, they are very dear to my heart.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah, it's a huge. It's given a people sort of a freedom to study things and learn things that they don't get in the classroom.
Yes, we definitely were open to all, and we're there as a resource and to connect people as well.
It's actually one of the most democratic institutions that we have, right? I mean, in terms of providing access to the public, which is partly why Black folk had fought so long and hard in so many places to gain that access, mm-hmm. because it really was this portal to opportunity.
How has Keisha teaching Black history and African American history changed over the years for you?
Well, and I guess I don't see us as being the teacher. We're the place.
Okay.
We provide the place for them to come in and to be able to gain knowledge. And we also offer programming. So through that programming, I feel that kids and adults have the opportunity to learn and to spark interest into knowledge. We offer a variety of programming, which I think is something that is wonderful because everybody doesn't learn in the same way.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe sitting down in the classroom, a child may not get it, may not receive that information, but through watching somebody do a first-person portrayal of a Tuskegee Airman, it might bring that to life for that individual, and it might make them want to dig deeper and to learn more about that. So I think that the library helps to open those doors for possibilities to learn more.
Do you see changing trends in what attracts young people to history?
You know, I think it's different for different children.
Okay.
Like you have some that are attracted to music. You have some that respond more to somebody sitting down and doing a lecture. So it depends on the child. And sometimes they react more by seeing how other people react to it. So if their friends are interested in it or they see how their mom or dad respond to it, that might be the thing that they latch on to and they find interest in.
Yeah.
One of the things that I'm astonished at, you know, we all talk about the cost of textbooks, but almost to a person, my students in both halves of African American history, they hang on to that textbook. That's the one textbook they don't sell. They keep that so that they can refer to it. And I think that's pretty terrific.
Wow. I'm going to turn on to Gail now in Columbus. It says here that you worked in textbooks, Gail. Welcome.
Yes, I worked in K through 12, and my comment is that before the kids get to college, you need to really be careful who gets on your board of education, because in my experience working in textbooks K through 12, what gets in the textbooks is largely predicated on what states adopt those textbooks. And in my experience, the two biggest states that your book will not get published unless California and Texas adopt your textbook.
Right.
And a few years back, I don't know if you remember, but in the Board of Education in Texas, there was some guy, he was a dentist, and a racist, and he got onto the Board of Education, and he started making sounds about, oh, this, you know, we can't have this and we can't have that. There's too much information in here about Martin Luther King. There's too much bad imagery about slavery, et cetera, et cetera. So my warning is that people, you know, I know people don't like to pay attention to down ticket politics, but it's very, very important to watch who gets onto your Board of Education, especially in, you know, big adopting states that adopt textbooks, because they have a lot of say-so of the content. Mm-hmm. And I'm telling you, that's where it starts, because mm-hmm. that's why so many kids, young kids, are not ready and don't know that much about racism and slavery, et cetera, by the time they get to college, because it's not in the textbooks in K through 12.
Yeah.
No, that is it's good advice. It's a fair warning, and it's true. And I think there's two things that we can do about it. One, I mean, beyond the politics, make sure we should heed the advice. You elect the good people to boards of education. But teachers can supplement with primary source material, and parents can supplement by going to their library, right?
That's right.
Those two things can really work to neutralize bad textbooks and really even enhance and flesh out the good ones.
Mm-hmm. We do a lot of work with primary sources in my classes.
Primary sources being letters written.
Letters, music.
Music, right.
A 1927 Model T Ford. anything that amplifies a story. I think it was developed at the time, and we do a lot with that. It's mostly documents, but we also have some material culture too.
Yeah,
we also, through the Columbus Metropolitan Library, have a Columbus African American digital collection, which is made up of primary resources. It's made by the community, so it's things that people have donated. We scan it and we get it back to them.
Uh-huh.
So you can get that through our website at columbuslibrary.org. But to me, it's one of those great tools that I try to promote to the students when they come in, because if they're researching, these are things that they can learn from. And being from Columbus myself, I learned a lot about Columbus working on that project.
Gail, thanks for that call. I want to turn now to Dee in Columbus. Dee, you're on the air.
Yes, this is Dee. I'm the profile child for Columbus, Ohio. I just wanted to touch on three points real quickly.
Uh-huh.
First of all, thank you for having me on air.
You bet.
First of all, I just wanted to go into it and let it be known that race and racism is simply a device word used to implement and define us in categories and to take us from making it a difference between us when in reality we're all human. So the more we forget that we're human and the more we categorize ourselves, the more we have stressful issues in life. Secondly, the tools of the racism is basically still implemented in our society today. I want to just define it a little more. We get away, we start categorizing races as this or that, but in reality, it's a spirit called ego and fear. And when you get these ego and fears too heavy in a person, that's when you get these actions of racism or actions of fear and hate, even towards each other. And these same rules and these same feelings and the same ego and fear exist in our system today with the law. When you control law and you're full of ego and fear, you have some actions that might seem racist. And an example of that is we don't have a camera law. It's a department regulation. But when I get pulled over 100 times and there's not one camera evidence, it's showing me that there's some sort of spirit still in control. And that spirit is called ego and fear. So let's get out of calling it racism, because we all do it to each other. And it's the same fear, ego, that killed off the Native American.
Well,
and where are they now?
Mm-hmm. Dee, hang on a second. What about the lexicon? What do you think about the words we use?
You know, the words are important, and the language is important. Dee is right in the sense that we are all human beings. In that sense, race genetically is meaningless. It has no biological meaning. But racism as a social construct is real. And race as a social construct is real. It's a way that historically we have created hierarchy in society. And we also – so we can't ignore that. That isn't just sort of human beings separated. I mean, it has real social value, although it is genetically meaningless. And at the same time, we can't deny sort of the impact of racism on people's lives. Yes, it is connected fundamentally in terms of prejudice, but it's prejudice and power that manifests in a very particular way. So I wouldn't be so quick to abandon both our understanding of what race is, both biologically meaningless, but socially meaningful, and also how we use it as a substitute, really to talk about, as a shorthand, to talk about sort of cultural inheritance and ancestry. Mm-hmm. So the language that we use is important, and we have to try to be as precise as possible, mm-hmm. but we also can't be ahistorical, right? Because that's still, that impacts the way we sort of engage the world today.
To add to what you said, the other thing that I'm always bothered by is this whole notion of color blindness. People always say, I don't see color. Mm-hmm. Well, of course you do. And when you do that, what you do is you erase the other person. You erase their experiences. You erase what's happening to them, what you can get from them. And so you go from one extreme to another. I'm racist, and the other extreme is color blindness, and when there is no such thing. And I think that's very dangerous.
Well, it's possible people are meaning it with the right intent, but they're just so self-unaware that.
Look, anything is possible, but part of the problem is you absolutely don't want to fall into the colorblind trap, right?
Saying because, it doesn't make it right. Yeah, it doesn't make it real.
The only thing that we see, only thing we don't see is race, right? Mm-hmm. You see gender, you see age. I mean, and it's the only thing we don't see is race. Like, yeah. No, you can see my color, you can see my culture, you can see my race. Just don't discriminate against me on the basis of what you see.
I wanted to ask all of you about the idea of Afrocentric schools. There's an Afrocentric school in Columbus. It's successful. They're doing a lot of great things there. But most of the students, if I'm not – correct me, I think they're African-American. I mean, it's not diverse in and of itself. What about that kind of arrangement for learning? How do you feel about that? Marilyn Howard?
I don't think that there's anything inherently wrong with an all-girls school, for instance, or something like that. But it goes as Lakeisha says, people learn so differently. And it just is one more environment in which that we can reach students. But again, because of the experience in here, we've gone the whole total way and say, well, you can't have a girls school, you can't have a boys school, you can't have this, you can't have that. Inherently, I see nothing wrong with that.
It works for some.
Yeah, it does. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
No, certainly. As a graduate of a historically black college and university, Morehouse College, I mean, that's sort of the epitome of an Afrocentric school, right? Mm-hmm. The value, especially because we live in a world in which white supremacy is still normative, where whiteness is still normative, you creating a space, an educational space, mm-hmm. where blackness becomes normative, mm-hmm. where you're not only recognizing and celebrating African American culture, but you're creating a space for children of color to learn and excel. You know, those are the types of places we need to double down on and invest in. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I think it's about the environment that the kids are growing up in as well. Just because if they go to a school that's Afrocentric doesn't mean that in their family or in other experiences they're not being introduced to people of other colors as well. Mm-hmm. So, you know, they could get that in other ways. And it's just a way to where they may be celebrating or teaching more about one culture.
Well, I want to thank you all for joining us today. The hour just flew by. Keisha Gibbs, she manages the Martin Luther King branch of the Columbus Metropolitan Library. Thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you.
Appreciate your time. And Marilyn Howard, she teaches African-American history at Columbus State Community College. Thanks for joining us. I appreciate
it. Thanks for having me. It was an honor.
And Hassan Kwame Jeffries, associate professor at Ohio State. He participated in that Southern Poverty Law Center study that we talked about earlier in the program. He hosts the Teaching Hard History podcast. We'll have a link to that on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. And he teaches African-American history at Ohio State. Thanks, as always, for joining us. I appreciate your time.
Always a pleasure. Thank you, Ann.
Thanks to everybody for all the great calls. Sorry we could not get to everybody, but I do appreciate your attention today. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.